Money FM 89.3, best of workday afternoon.
This is Money FM 89.3. I'm Clarissa Monter for the workday afternoon. It's been just about a week since the lifting of Circuit Breaker Phase 1. How are we doing? And what should we know about COVID-19 now? We get a timely update from Dr. Sean Vasu, Clinical Director at the National Centre of Infectious Diseases, coming up next on Health Suites on Money FM 89.3.
Health Suites with Clarissa Montero on Money FM 89.3.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health Suites on Money FM 89.3. I'm Clarissa Montero, joined on the phone today by Dr. Sean Vasu, Clinical Director, NCID. Doctor, welcome to the show.
All right, thanks, Clarissa. Yeah.
Now, the first reported case of COVID-19 in Singapore was, we're walking back a little bit here, was in late January this year. That was an imported case. Now, since then, we've had community spread, we've had fatalities, and as Singaporeans, we've lived through a circuit breaker. What do we now know about this disease?
The world essentially has gotten to know this virus over a course of 6 months. Before that, never described. It has two distant relatives, SARS of 2003 and MERS, as you know. And this is the third zoonotic coronavirus to have jumped the species barrier and has caused a big outbreak. Unlike SARS of 2003 and MERS, we now know that COVID-19 is much more efficient in its spread and much more varied in its presentation. SARS, we had clear signs of fever. People were infectious when they had a fever and had symptoms. MERS, it's been largely centered in the Middle East, and you had usually had some camel or healthcare contact, and it affected older men. But here we have a disease which has ranged from very mild symptoms or no symptoms to very severe in presentation. So on this global scale, it has affected many, many more people. The spread has been much more unprecedented compared to SARS and MERS. And what is more puzzling and more difficult and tricky is a smart virus. It has a much more varied presentation, so all the way from asymptomatic to severe. What we know now is that thankfully, although it has spread, most people have a mild form of the disease. 80% are either mild or they have minimal symptoms or no symptoms. 20% have severe disease, and when we say that, means a more severe form of pneumonia, and about 5% or less are critically ill, depending on which country you are. I think thankfully in Singapore, our numbers in the ICU have been remarkably low. So we have learned a lot. We also learned that it's not only affecting the lungs, it has a lot of other things, that organs that it might affect, that we are learning about. We do now know that somehow it tends to be associated with blood clots, and sometimes it can cause other issues even after the infection resolves. What's remarkable also, very early in the outbreak, Chinese scientists published the whole genetic sequence, so that really has helped us a lot learning about the virus, and also now we have at least a few promising treatments for the severely ill.
Now, Professor Leo Yee Sin, the director of NCID, has gone on record and said COVID-19 could be with us for a long time. The WHO has said it may never go away. What does that really mean for us, the public? Will social distancing measures become a permanent fixture in our lives, for example?
Yeah, so I think people have felt that it might be with us for a long time. It might not go away because COVID-19 may cause asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic disease. Because it does that, then it can circulate undetected in populations. And because its symptoms are also indistinguishable from other common respiratory viruses. What's different from COVID-19 is not just another common cold or influenza that we can ignore, because we do know that it causes severe disease at a much higher rate than the other common respiratory viruses. Now, it will not go away unless two things happen. And the first thing is herd immunity, maybe it's not too good to have, because it does mean that a lot of human infections and also then the attendant complications, a lot of people may be having severe illness and possibly dying if it does kind of spread through a population. But if it does happen, it means that you achieve a certain level of immunity in a population, and then the virus will not efficiently propagate, but that means a lot of human infections. The second way it might go away then scientifically would be effective vaccine. And I think there are many groups working on a vaccine. And if we have an effective vaccine which is deployed, which causes immunity, then the virus will have a harder time to spread. And I think we could possibly then see COVID-19 being kept at bay. But even then, depending on vaccine uptake rates and also the level of herd immunity, we need to be careful that there would not be a resurgence. So at least I think COVID, my opinion is that until we have an effective vaccine, then COVID-19 is likely to be here to stay at least for the next couple of years or so on a semi-permanent basis.
Okay, we'll come back to that herd immunity just a little while from now, but let's zoom in on vaccines first, because all eyes are on vaccines. And you're right, everyone in the world seems to be trying to run this race to bring a vaccine to us. Are we still 18 months away? And in the meantime, what does that mean for us?
Yeah, so I think 18 months, which is a year and a half, will be a rather optimistic time frame, in my opinion, for effective and deployable vaccine. I think it can happen, and we all hope it does. Vaccine development is inherently challenging. The fastest viral vaccine which has been developed worldwide was the mumps vaccine, and that took 4 years. But of course, now we are in the year 2020, and we have the benefit of newer technologies and multiple groups all over the world working on this. So I would say that we could do better than the 4 years it took to develop the mumps vaccine, but I would say that our attitude would be one of cautious optimism. I believe that meanwhile, while we are waiting for a vaccine, though, human behavior, which is our social etiquette, what we can do in terms of social distancing, and it should be calibrated according to what's happening in each country, will be here to stay until effective vaccine arrives.
So no chance of us just dropping the whole concept of social distancing anytime soon?
No, not yet. I think we all kind of think back to what we were doing over last Christmas and the New Year, and we wish could go back to those days straight away. But I think that would be a bit, you know, too optimistic right now. And I think, yes, it will be here to stay. I think what's important, it's going to be calibrated. I think it's still important. I think sensible policies and sensible actions and attitudes on behalf of the public in terms of calibrated social distancing and kind of paying attention to what's happening in the country and with the health authorities advising us what to do. So I think that's here to stay for a while, and we should adhere to it, because I don't think we all want to go back to the really tight circuit breaker days. And I think if we all put in our efforts, we can beat this virus.
Okay, so you're saying social distancing is here to stay.
Yes, here to stay for a bit more.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball to say how long more, but at least for the rest of this year, at least, I believe. And we'll see what happens next year. But who knows, we might get a vaccine sooner than expected, and we'll see how that helps us.
Yeah. All right. We're speaking with Dr. Sean Vasu, Clinical Director at the NCID now. There has been mention of waves of the epidemic interspersed with periods of low-level transmission. Is there any concern that this will lead to complacency in the public? We talked about social distancing, that we'll let our guard down, and this will lead, in turn, to another spike of infections.
Yeah, so, well, I think certainly fatigue and frustration can lead to complacency. I think we have seen it, not maybe because of complacency, but for different reasons. When different countries around the world have come out of their equivalent circuit breaker period, I think it's very important and to take reference to what is happening around the world. Some countries have seen increases in infection rates. And usually it happens in various hotspots where there's less social distancing. So it's important to have measures which are adopted and calibrated dynamically, and also that these are informed by good surveillance systems and testing. So we should not overdo measures to lead to complacency and fatigue. So it's a fine kind of a hammer and dance which people have talked about. So kind of hammering out known pockets of infection, and then kind of a dance where we calibrate our measures according to what data that feeds our public health action. So I think that's important. I think sometimes it's not complacency, but, you know, travel can be still essential, and especially travel for work. And as we see, when things open up a bit more, for travel for business, which is essential. And, you know, we cannot, Singapore cannot remain isolated perpetuity. And, you know, there will be some degree worldwide of global travel eventually, but I believe it will be introduced in a calibrated way. And that per se is not complacency, but that's, you know, what is essential to public good and work and essential business. So, you know, if that happens in an uncontrolled fashion, and if we don't take heed to implementing certain measures with the opening of travel, then in that sense, we would be letting our guard down, and infections could very well spike. So I think we need good data to feed us with good information that will inform us with regards to public health and clinical action downstream.
Okay, most of us have heard the term herd immunity, but most of us also don't really understand what it means. Could you give us a brief overview of what that actually is?
Yeah, so herd immunity is basically the number of people in a population who have gone through the infection, have developed kind of immunity, which means they have developed antibodies, for example, to an infection, and such that when you have a critical mass of people who have the infection, then it is harder to spread from person to person and cause a large outbreak. So, for example, I'm just drawing an example, it's just a simple illustration. If a room has perhaps 9 people who are immune to the virus and only 1 person, then of course that person cannot spread by definition to the other 9 people because they're immune to it. So if the room has 8 people, then of course theoretically he could spread it to one other person. But of course it depends how big your room is and how many interactions they have, how near the people are each to each other, and how efficient the spread of the virus is. So in general, when we talk about herd immunity, is the level of immunity that a population has, which will prevent efficient spread. And I guess people are looking at it specifically for COVID. I think it varies from virus to virus. For COVID, people, depending on how efficient the virus is in propagation, then some people have done some estimates for COVID, and they have said maybe you need about 60 to 70% of the population to be immune. If we assume that there's another number that we look at called the R0, how efficient the propagation of the virus is. So, for example, R0 of 4 would mean that one person can spread to four susceptible people. So assuming this number R is from between 2 to 4, so one person might infect 2 to 4 other people, then some epidemiologists have estimated that you need between about 60 to 70% of people having herd immunity before we can kind of stop the propagation of COVID-19. Of course, herd immunity could come through natural infection. It could also come through a vaccine.
Right, okay. But I can understand why earlier you were referring to it, and it's not a great option in terms of a natural, you know, the population naturally getting this illness, because you are dealing with an aging population.
That's right. Yeah, if you have infection kind of burning through a population, then you would expect a lot of, if it happens all at a go, for example, in the very hard hit cities which were hit by COVID-19, then that could really overwhelm systemically the medical health system, and also it could cause a lot of people having complications from the disease, especially the people who are older.
I think this one is actually quite important to the parents who have now started seeing their children go back to school. In the US, they started seeing a new syndrome in children, which is now being called pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or PMIS. Experts aren't sure if it's linked to COVID-19. Many doctors think it is. Is there any concern for that for our children here in Singapore?
Yeah, so from the preliminary reports which have come out from Europe and, I mean, the UK in particular in the US, there is a syndrome which quite clearly seems to be associated with COVID-19. And it's called the pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. It shares some features in common with another inflammatory disease we call Kawasaki disease, mm-hmm. with some other features. For example, in Kawasaki disease, you don't see lung or respiratory symptoms as common, but because COVID affects the respiratory system, it's seen and described a bit more in this PMIS. However, much more work is needed in understanding why and how it tends to occur in certain children. Thankfully, the majority of children who have been infected with COVID-19 in various parts of the world, they have had very, very mild disease and they have recovered. Some of them are asymptomatic. We haven't seen this in Singapore yet. We do see Kawasaki disease, which is an inflammatory disease which affects children, and it causes inflammation in various organs and in blood vessels. That's thought to be triggered off by an unknown infectious trigger. So there might be various triggers for Kawasaki disease, but here we have COVID-19 possibly triggering off a Kawasaki-like syndrome. However, this has been described mainly in Western countries right now. We're not sure. Of course, the term Kawasaki disease, immediately you think of something Japanese because it is described more. The traditional Kawasaki disease is described more in Asia and in Orientals. However, this new syndrome has been described mainly in children in the West when it's associated with COVID. So I don't think we know enough about it yet, but I think we will learn much more. But thankfully in Singapore, we have not, I'm not aware that we have seen COVID-19 related Kawasaki-like syndrome. And it's something though here our pediatricians are watching out for.
All right. Well, let's hope that that stays the case and we don't see it among our young.
Yes. Yeah. Certainly.
All right, Doctor, thank you so much for your time. We've been speaking with Dr. Sean Vasu, Clinical Director, NCID. We really, really appreciate you speaking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome, Clarissa. Thank you.
I'm Clarissa Montero for Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.